last case on our docket was Sadkowski, Eli Lilly, 97-1142. This case, Justice Resnick has recused herself, and we're privileged and honored to have Judge Quillen from the 9th District Court of Appeals. Thank you for coming, Judge Quillen. Welcome. Before we begin, Ms. Wheeler, respondent has indicated to the court staff that they have a chart. Do either of you have any objection to their using a chart? Do? On what basis? Okay, well then we'll let the court make the decision at the time. Thank you very much. We'll note your objection.
Okay.
You may proceed.
The district court has certified a question to the court whether or not, in essence, Ohio PS victims have a meaningful remedy under Ohio law. The context of that certification was that the district court found that Ohio recognized the market share remedy for PS victims. The federal appellate court examining
Our certified belief is the final order
and the private liability of the trust. Those two kinds of claims are distinct from market share. Statutory language file. So then our attention turns to, is there a common law claim? Is there a claim out there for market share of the government or the U.S. business? The Golden versus John Stansfield case in 1987, this court, for the first and only time in Russian market share liability, the contract of the asbestos. EDF is a separate point of that opinion, and a basis for distinguishing asbestos from the appropriate kind of product for which market share recovery is available. The court's position was that EDF is fungible, asbestos is certainly not such a cost. The court also discussed issues regarding the complexity of asbestos litigation as just being distinct from the more simple kind of product liability statement EDF might present. Unfortunately, before 1988, this court did not have presented to it directly a market share claim on EDF. But we know from the discussion in Goldman, market share was considered and there was no statement suggesting market share as part of our body of law.
Yeah, we clearly considered that in Goldman, and Goldman wasn't a unanimous decision, but isn't it fair to argue that when you do market share liability, you do away with proximate cause?
Absolutely not.
Why?
The plaintiff still has a responsibility to show that injuries are proximate cause by exposure to EDF. The plaintiff still has a responsibility to show that the product is destructive in common and high-priced code. The only responsibility or burden that shifted away from the plaintiff is identifying the specific manufacturer. Every other element of the claim is still present with the money. We can't walk in court and say, here we are, where EDF exposed, give us money. Market share liability only shows that we can walk in court, and we finally get an opportunity to show that none of the manufacturers actually tested the product.
Is it fair to say that without market share liability, that in all of these product cases where you can't identify a specific manufacturer, that one of them could never be won? Not just DES, but asbestos, and I mean, if you cannot identify all of them, all of the companies, or identify a specific company's product, without market share liability, the case is over, isn't it?
For any product where you can't, under the way the law is currently set up, if you can't identify the manufacturer, that is not to say that that is market share that's been excluded from our counsel.
Could you tell me, Ed, to make the case for why market share, not whether or not it's been pre-decided or excluded, but why market share is the appropriate rule in a DES case? I assume that it's not. You don't have a group of potential plaintiffs who can show the manufacturer, or do, because their doctors, their physicians' records, or their pharmacists' records are available, and others are foreclosed because no records are obtainable at this point as to what was prescribed and how that prescription is filled.
There are two referrals to identify the manufacturer. One is the lengthiness of the disease that happened at the time that caused a lot of work to the wrong. The second referral is that Dr. Vessel or Dr. Vessel was commonly referred to by generic. There are some companies that did produce a brand of Dr. Vessel or Vessel, for example, just like that they're commonly. Some women recall that they took us. Some women don't have the pharmacy prescription. For those women, they had identification of the facts available. But the fact of the matter, many of these pharmacies did not make that information on the record, did not make that information on the profile.
So, how large universe are we talking about? Is this a small portion of the population that potentially complains? In which the pharmacy would not have kept a record as to what they dispensed?
I think that a very, very small population of women who identify as manufacturers, they absolutely expect these women to not identify as manufacturers. If they actually identify as manufacturers, are they still in the years where you have a market share? What would you say that manufacturer is out of business? If they can identify their manufacturer, they have lost them. If they are no longer good, if they can take a judgment, there's an argument made that your proposal is not required to introduce a fine for that. No, I don't. That is a kind of horrible that is complete throughout the climate. What we are arguing about from the plaintiff's perspective is that we would ask for a so-called due diligence requirement. And that is essentially that then want, as part of our burden, evidence that the plaintiff is somehow performing due diligence. What does that mean? I can tell you from the evidence of the insurance, you definitely try to find pharmacy, you try to find recommended food, but what is the burden about that? That's part of any liability student to try to find out who's responsible. Why should you be relieved of that burden? We're not asking to relieve those burdens. Could you just get a factor? What we're asking for is to relieve us of a specific due diligence burden of proof in your case. Why should you be accepted in the end of the Because, number one, the information is better found in the end. They have better access to records, their own internal records, and pharmacy records. Number two, we still aren't specifically drawing a line for what the burden is on the front.
So how much due diligence or lack of due diligence should you be trying to do? What do you think your burden should be trying to find out to do?
I believe that it is an enormous step to identify the manufacturer. Because if you go under a market share period liability, there are risks attendant on that in terms of the field.
You have to answer the question, what should be your duty as a what protection do you require to do your
duty? I believe that if a woman has attempted to locate the pharmacist, attempted to locate the mother's physician, although the manufacturer identification records may not be the physician's records, she has accomplished what she should be doing.
What is important that's depending beyond that? You say it's too much of a burden.
Their suggestion is that somehow part of the argument, and you can strengthen it quite recently, many of these women have known since they were very extremely over the exposed. The argument that when she was 17 she found out she was exposed and she didn't go, it's only the post. The moving pharmacist at that time, but she didn't exercise due diligence. What we are aware of is that due diligence is not a part of the market share application in other states, and that is because there is such potential for a very extreme position being taken, making the burden on the top over a plaintiff to ever prove that she was sufficiently diligent. We hear that even today that plaintiffs are not sufficiently diligent, that somehow records have been lost because they knew that there was a DRA2 that they were exposed and they didn't want to take the tax that they've ever paid for the deposition. Well, at that time they didn't know they had any interest, so I wouldn't say that. What we are asking courts to do is not only to adopt sure a cause of action and expressly recognize it, but also address the very issues that you're talking about, and that's kind of the type of market share that we are looking for here. If you look toward the Collins case out of Wisconsin, they're talking about a practical, very easily applied type of market share. The burden is correctly shifted to those entities that are best able to determine who is in the market and who will share their burden. There is the Collins type of market share does away with market share trials. It does away with arguments about exploitation. It does away with the due diligence and potential share arguments. It is a straightforward dovetail in fact into our existing linearity computation on point features concept.
But they have a reasonable point, do they not? Do you have your brief with you?
No, Your
Honor. Okay. So I think on page 28 of your brief, you say petitioners would have the courts apply a subjective test. You mean respondents? Okay, and twice in that paragraph. So
yeah.
Now we'll go straight. What we really want to read is respondents would have the courts apply a subjective test before a determination of non-identification is made.
Yes.
Why should there not be a subjective test?
Because it would not be a consistent standard in terms of being joined with the subject to acknowledge your claim of right to command your Cleveland or Columbus. Have you done enough diligence? That is a burden that, in effect, will also prevent many worthy claims from being brought.
Do they have any right to expect you to do anything except, say, market share, you're all in it, give us money?
Under the application of market share liability, the obligation to identify is out there. It is in their best interest to also identify the interaction. And is there greater access to others? That has happened in taking some of it now.
Okay, that's my second question. On that point, we have a stack of briefs, as you know, and it was one of the amicus, I believe, that said, doing this doesn't, if we do market share, it doesn't leave any way for a manufacturer who can't possibly be liable to opt out. For instance, that they took it by injection as opposed to pill. Now that seemed like a reasonable argument to me. If they can't be liable, how can they be included in the market share?
Well, Your Honor, that's exactly why I objected to that chart, because that kind of argument is a misrepresentation of how market share is out. When we're talking about exploitation issues and setting up the market, even under the Wisconsin form of market share liability, the plaintiff has to show the type of DMT. So if you, your mother receives an injection, the people who do not produce injectables are not properly part of their market. The same.
So you'd let them opt out?
Well, that would be a function of the, it's technically called exploitation.
Yes.
And they would be included initially until that determination is made that they did not produce that product.
And that's why you'd like the market share to be the allocated market as opposed to the total market.
If you're going to require that plaintiffs include a substantial share of the manufacturers, which is not an element of the OIP or under the common decision, then you have to rule if you look at what we do. There's been two market matrix. In both of those market matrices, there are certain years when at most 58% of the market has been identified in terms of who produced what and what amounts. and they never tested the drug, and they it wasn't effective for what they did, for what they supposed to do. It is, when you're talking about what is public policy here, who are we trying to protect? We protect the people who were born in their mother's body and were subjected to this dangerous drug, or we protect the drug companies who were in the best position to control what went into the market, what was told to the doctors and the public, and to adequately monitor this drug once it's introduced into the stream of commerce. Waited all these years to increase the price, and now the Boston Roundup, you can't find it. I guess that's too bad. We're talking about a public policy decision that marks your liability, does nothing more than shifts the burden of responsibility. And this is public policy from the national legislature to do that. The public policy is also part of our common law. It's about form fix, it's about use of life. And this court has long held a tradition of protecting people and high liability clients from unethical and unsafe products and shifting burdens between claimants and people responsible for the damage.
You wanted to save some time and you're all out now, so we'll give you all the time in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Dillon, sir?
Thank you, Judge Sutter. In light of the objection out of time, I will not try and use the adjustment dealing with that issue and objections to it.
Thank you, sir.
My name is James Dillon, and I stand before you as liaison counsel for the 18 defendants in this case. I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about the 18 defendants and a little bit about DES before I get to the arguments as to why this court should not enact market share as the law of Ohio. And I want to do the facts and part of the response. The arguments for market share expressed by and so now we talk based on facts or assumed facts or certain facts. I'd like to lay some things out that will help, I think, to understand what market share would in fact take. The 18 defendants who are here in this court are not an industry or market. They're not most of the companies that made EDS and doses used for pregnancies. The 18 defendants here are less than 6% of the 272 companies that made this drug over a period of years. Not only are they not the industry, but it's been already determined again and again and again that they are not representative of an industry or market in that sense. Judge Alden, the district court judge who sent this to the court, on the basis of undisputed facts and proof, determined that none, that for class action purposes, there were literally no questions of law or fact common to the DES cases involving all of these defendants and all of these plaintiffs. Literally no questions that are common. She also decided, and that's in a 160 federal rule decision sitting by class action. Thereafter, in 1995, she also decided on a lesser standard that cases could not even be joined together because the issues were so different. Issues about the defendants, issues about the plaintiffs. About the defendants, Judge Alden found, based on the record in front of her, that in fact the product literature, the warnings, the indications by these defendants and by the company were not the same. They're not the same. Over time, they're not the same among the companies. It's also very important to recognize that what we're talking about is a period of time in the 40s and 50s before they were package inserts. Now they're being a package insert on record with the FDA.
Doesn't all that you have said go to class action?
No, Your Honor, it goes to the issue of liability, because the liability cause of action in Ohio for a prescription drug is based on an analysis of warning. It's a question of fact. Seeley versus Gene Searle case talks about the element and so the elements of cause of action, focusing in on this. If they're different, then you can't make the assumption that some entity that is not enforced, or likely not enforced, must have been negligent because their warning was inadequate.
It sounds to me like what your argument is that the Judge Aldridge just found no liability. Why would she have certified this question to us?
I'm not touching it at all.
Oh, okay.
It's certainly possible that there can be liability. Let me just say the differences among the defendants. I mention that because I think when we come to talk about bases for the presumed bases in the market here, I think that you will find that only the
counsel, is the product fund or
the, there are two questions, the product fund for, and for liability purposes, the defendant fund.
That's where you seem to be, you're saying the defendant isn't,
the defendant, product is. So that's a relevant question for liability. I will also say, my reason, it's important to recognize that refundability, that's a federal charge, that's a policy that's been asserted. Florida Industries has a long brief on this issue, pointing out that for FDA purposes, determining whether they're being the same drug product, that the mere fact that they have the same ingredient is not enough to make it the same drug product.
But that's important to test whether or not it's market share.
It is one of the elements of market share, Your Honor, that the plaintiff's patent was never approved. The suggestion is that there's real content about that, it's real. But I think, Your Honor, that the real issue for us is not just that it's not functional, not proven. But it's not really a question, as the plaintiff's patent, that they simply want to shift one element of the cause of law, that's an application. To shift that burden and otherwise it's the same. I'm submitting to you, Your Honor, that they really don't want the day in court. They need to change the very elements of the cause of action, the hardwire in decisions that the jury would make now. The jury would make decisions now about whether the warning is active or not. The jury would make decisions about whether there's a speedy cause. The jury would make decisions about whether the defendants had rebutted the presumption that an adequate.
Well, counsel, what is the certified question?
The question is, does, I should have that to tip my tongue, but it's a, is market share liability a viable cause of action?
Okay, and that's the only question we answer. So, it seems to me part of where you're going, a lot of where you're going, is if we answer in the affirmative, then there are lots of other things that you still have an opportunity to contest vigorously in the federal court. But that's really not fundamental to our answering the question. Was it precluded by the statutory enactment? If not, do we find there is an opportunity for market share? And if we do, what should be the test? I'm not quite clear whether we even get to the petitioner suggests the Collins test, whether that's a part of our answer or should be a part of our answer, if we were to answer the affirmative.
Your Honor, I think two responses to that, and of course they both carry a bunch of thoughts and they're trying to respond. But partly, the main answer is that, in fact, the petitioner are not saying, just give us a chance to try a case of court. And if I focus on the elements of the cause of action against prescription drug manufacturers in Ohio, and the focus on what the process cause means, these are really subjective in front of you because the common law of Ohio for a long time and currently is inevitable to market share. That market share while the California Supreme Court may have thought that just involved a shift in group identification, really, when you analyze it, really involves very fundamental changes in the nature of the cause of action. One could not do the kind of proximate cause analysis that this court did in Jefferson v. Alexa if you didn't know which drug company was involved, if you didn't know what their warnings said, if you were precluded from dealing with issues about intervening cause, because the defendants are effectively, by the very nature of the cause of action, precluded from saying, whoa, even if there was a market, I only had at best 1%. It's overwhelmingly likely that that's not me, and someone else is more likely than not the cause of any harm. Proximate cause, in no rational sense in the law of Ohio, or in the restatement, is something that runs from an inanimate product to an injury. Proximate cause is, in fact, an analysis of the acts of the defendant, where the acts of such, with the knowledge of such, that they have created a defect in the product, and therefore that act is the cause. It's not, there is no rational way for it to happen to be the proximate cause of the male going against the arm that counts, not that act. So it is not just that the
and
court is
explain that to me in terms of DEFs.
Okay.
I lost on your hammer.
My hammer was bad. point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is that the evidence of a cause of action, someone coming in who claims against the manufacturers, would in fact have to prove, among other things, that the warning that the manufacturer made was inadequate, and that that inadequate warning was in fact the proximate cause of the doctor prescribing that drug, and that that prescription was in fact now the cause of the injection of the drug. And then there's also an actual causation, and that is that the pharmaceutical product was also the actual cause of the drug. That's different from proximate cause.
You keep talking a lot about the warning, but yet you indicate that that is very much later to be. So the bulk of the women involved in taking the initial drug did not get back to us.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
And was it a standard practice at that time for doctors to be oral warnings, or was that not the case?
Your Honor, I don't know the inherent facts that I think would be useful to know. Certainly, the duty of the drug manufacturer then and now is to release a drug that was designed to be a doctor.
Let's say it's a standard sense of facts to be able to stand and argue that no HIV is struggling against the drug that gave up warnings for them to take this drug. And let's say it's a claim of cancer that the FDA is a direct possibility of HIV AIDS. Why shouldn't all of those manufacturers then that participated in Avia and making that product bear upon liability because of the difficulty? Because that was the public policy argument that when you look at a woman who had no recourse and suffered seriously under the product versus a company that made a lot of money, the public policy argument favors doing some sort of remedy that gives them a solution. What's your argument against that?
There are several presumptions that are part of that, Your Honor, and in a way, the language of strict liability is that it's better, with respect to an innocent plaintiff or a company, to lay the liability onto a company that can spread the cause. And that is a justification for strict liability that has been used. Strict liability with respect to a prescription drug is a little bit different, because you need to look at the different warnings. But let me keep with that language of responsibility. There is no basis on which the fact that somebody else made a drug which was prescribed by a doctor and may have caused an injury, that some other company did that, my being held responsible for that does nothing to help me make a better and safer product. There is no lesson I can learn from somebody else's product. Certainly, I could not have raised the price of my product to have covered that because it's not mine. I couldn't have bought insurance to somebody else's product because it's not mine. And it's also, if you think about it, part of the proximate cause issue that this court talked about, and Judge Gillespie talked about it, the cost of that issue about its own responsibility. Normally, what would think that a drug company would conclude that its responsibility ran those entities who took its product as opposed to another product. But also, Your Honor, I think what you've done is you've made an assumption about liability and innocence. Fair enough. I will point out to you that when these cases are in fact tried, the differences are substantial enough that defendants win. The vast majority of my client, Eli Lilly, has been involved in 22 verdicts on the merit of 117. But that proves to us that we can lose. And proves to us also that, by and large, we can win. Because we think our state of the art is right. We have our fortune. We don't have somebody else's. And the other issue that is important is there are so many different conditions that are present in our case. If we want to uniform world, some of these arguments would make no sense, but there are an array of things that are asserted. This is not what we have to reveal to study. The best we can make out is that she is maintaining that in 1977 she had one miscarriage. Now, there are many causes of miscarriage. There are some articles that talk about miscarriage being increased in that particular study population. But I assure you, Your Honor, and Justice, that there are other studies that point out no difference. So we have a real, it's not fair to assume that all the defendants must be. It's not fair to assume that all of them are liable. That we break down some of this issue about spreading out between the innocent and the wrongdoers. I think that what you pointed out, though, is that market share in many ways rests on that premise, which I think is a premise that needs to be examined. It doesn't exist in any other cause of action. To the degree that market share in its actual institution is decides to take issues away from the jury, issues that are now part of the cause of action. It is pretty radically changed the law of Ohio. Just as an example, unlike alternative liability that this court has talked about, there being a real nexus between what both patrons, suppliers of asbestos did. There was no alternative liability in the gold. But this court noted that there was no testimony, no proof that the defendant's court had actually come into contact with that and supplied asbestos did in the place where the scene was. That nexus is critically important. It's a fundamental piece of responsibility of liability in Ohio. Market share absolutely destroys that person. It is incompatible with fundamental principles of Ohio law. That's what the Sixth Circuit said. Ohio. They didn't just say that it wasn't found in the 1980 statute.
Counsel, the certified question really asks us whether or not the concept is precluded from consideration in this case. Much of what you've argued to us is that in the case of many plaintiffs, injury may be unrelated to DES or it may not be as profound. But all of us, I think that the question is it precluded? And we have to answer that yes or no. And if we answer it no, that's the end of it. If we answer it yes, then the question becomes, do we elaborate or should we elaborate? And I'd like to get you to that point. The opposing counsel did point to two or three different approaches that have been taken. Should we hand that back to the federal judge if we answer in the affirmative, or should we address the standard, including getting into if you can prove that your company didn't market that product in that form, or didn't market it in that state, should be able to opt out, and also the other issue that was discussed of who should carry the burden of going forward and how much burden of what doctor, what pharmacy, what records are available that might show precisely the name. Should we get into all of that if we answer the affirmative?
I think that there is no way that you can avoid doing that. And one of my questions to this court would be, on what facts would you make those decisions? Without facts here, I think that we're going to do that. I think it's unfair to come back. But let me also say that getting to the point of forms of market share that we're discussing by saying that what my argument has been is that the law, the common law of Ohio, the elements of the cause of action preclude market share. Let me also say that, in my view, the statute, the Ohio Product Liability Act, precludes market share.
How so?
Because it incorporates the common law of Ohio. The very elements of the cause of action focus and drive examination of the woman.
Is there some place in the Act where it said this, from this day forward, will be the sum and substance of the totality of the law of product liability in the state?
This court has recited that the subject to language it has not preclusive of pre-existing common law or of things and of things that are not covered by the Act. The fact is that, while Bishop mentioned this, the Goldman case actually rejected market share liability, so it was not part of the common law before 1988. And the petitioner is relying on the statute to supply the liability part of market share liability. So it's not as if market share liability is not covered by the Act. They are relying, raising it to
it. Let me back to the question. There's a great deal of content in the merits that if we adopt market share, this is the type of human market that we adopt. Is that a brief representative view of all of the things? Is that just the
merits? It is representative of the view of my clients, and I believe on most defendants as well. And let me turn to that, and I'm going to ask about that. If, in fact, this court does, through the legislative and public policy, and I'm enacting market share, there is some agreement, at least there used to be some agreement between the petitioner and the respondent. Now there's some suggestion of you that we have not responded to Wisconsin. But prior to that, what the petitioner had been talking about was Sindel. And Sindel at least had some evidence, even though it's now turned out that when you examine my rule on the chain, find out that 169 out of 172 companies in ABS don't have any city records, and they don't have zero. What you find out is that there is no real record of what the market is for use of pregnancy. But at least they didn't put the finger on some national market issues. They did say in Sindel that it would certainly not be several, I believe, it would certainly not be joint, I believe. It would be several, I believe, which would also be they did require the punctuality improved. Let me, since I'm running out of time, let me focus on some of the areas where at least in Greece, petitioner may respond to the office. One is the due diligence issue. Why should these particular plaintiffs, who do not even allege they cannot identify, please be clear that this account alleges only that it would be inconvenient. It would be unreasonably difficult to do it because they can't. But if in fact they do identify them, they should take their risks as defined them. They are not asking something that they are on the issue of exclamation, the same thing. It's not really a shift of group identification. If when in fact the defendant can stand up and carry that burden, they're excluded from doing so. So exclamation must be part of it. And the last point, if I may, I realize I'm over, this is the last point I had. The last point is really about a substantial share of the market. But the California Court, too, by putting that in, was expressly trying to mitigate what it knew was the unfairness of market share of the market. That likely is not if two-thirds of the market were there, then in fact, at least there's a good chance that the wrongdoer, alleged wrongdoer, was actually before it can stand up. What happens is that, as the petition pointed out, not all those records are found. The petition now really wants to get rid of that mitigation. And not only that, but falling only name a substantial share of that market, which is determined by who the California people sued and where they found records. So if only 50% of the market is found in 1952, they want to sue 50%, 50%, or 25% of the market. And by the way, just naming shouldn't be enough. They really ought to be advised to prove this. So imagine you have a market where 75% is actually determined and present for. They only prove, imagine, liability against 5%, and not prove liability against 70%. Where is the theoretical basis for applying the market share of liability on anyone? Is the absent person more like the 5%, where they will be that one with that? Or are they more like the 70%?
Those are all things we have to think about. Thank you, Mr. Day. Ms. Wheeler, we're on a very tight schedule today. We normally would give you 30 seconds, but we'll give you 2 minutes. But when the light comes on, you're finished, okay?
Thank you, sir. One point I want to stress is that we're not talking about, did they warn these people about the bad things that were going to happen? The point we are making is that the public was expected to get better precedent. They put out the market because our pressure was wrong. Now, it is a sufficient thing, I would suppose, in regardless of the type of case you have, if you can walk in and depend on the liability issue by saying, yes, we tested drugs and we warned doctors that if they gave the drug a frame for it, then it's going to be.
Counsel, we're not here to determine the merits of dispensing DBS. You have suggested the application of the Collins test. You suggested certain things about burdens. We have a certified question. It could be answered yes or no. We have limited facts. How are we going to, if we answer in the affirmative, build out a sensible rule under which to operate?
You are a fortunate court to have the operation of other courts and their evaluation of the market share form to take.
In other states.
Exactly.
So why shouldn't we let the federal judge just do that?
Because this is not final ruling, and it is uniquely appropriate for this court to talk about the kind of form in which you take. The Collins case did a very good job of evaluating the clustering countries, the Sindel case, and the Martin case out of Washington. What I do want to point out is that you're not making a decision in a vacuum.
is your last point.
Very briefly, there's some discussion about the representation of the manufacturers and manufacturing. I want to clarify that for the court. Judge Aldrich long ago required us to dismiss out any defendants that we did not have evidence that produced the drug in the year each client was born. So we made a note that, for example, in 1971, there's only about 7 manufacturers who produced 21% of the market. We would include 272 defendants when all but 7 of them are out of life. So that explains the composition of our current.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We'll take it under advisement and render our opinion in due course. Marshal, please adjourn the court.
All rise. Hear you, hear you, hear you. Open session. All the free.